options activity has altered the investment landscape. Get an edge on this massive flow of funds with Tier 1 Alpha's Market Situation Report, brought to you by HedgEye, a daily newsletter of the latest moves in the options market and a weekly webcast featuring myself, Mike Green of Simplify Asset Management, and Tier 1 Alpha's Craig Peterson and David Pegler. Go to HedgEye.com/research for more information.
Hi, I'm HedgEye's founder, Keith McCullough. If you like what you hear, you will love our investing research. We bring transparency, accountability, and actionable investing ideas to investors big and small. I'll put our investing process and team up against anyone in the world. Please visit HedgEye.com to subscribe and learn a better way to invest.
I'm Keith McCullough, and welcome back. If you did it, 3 for 3, 6 for 6. We've done 6 in 2 days. And I'm quite looking forward to this one and enjoy it, Dan, when we get the time to sit down together. The last time we did, lots of great feedback. You're such a thoughtful guy, and you started it, and you're still with it. Congrats, first of all, on your 10-year anniversary, is it?
Thank you, Keith. Yeah, in this business, survival is a win, so we're delighted to have survived for 10 years.
10 years. Running money, correct me if I'm wrong, if you started out of your dorm with like less than, well, some very small amount of money.
You got it. $8 million on day one.
And now you're over $1 billion?
We just made it, yep.
That's awesome.
So thank you, Keith.
Yeah, how many times did you think about packing it in?
March of 2020. Yeah. You can, you name it. Yeah, I mean, it's a tough business, but you know, I think what you and I share is I find markets endlessly fascinating. I mean, so if you have an intellectually curious mind, the scope for research and ideas, and I also love that you're betting on ideas. You know, yes. I thought often about going to become a professor or something, but what I don't like about that is who cares if you're right or wrong? I mean, there's no stake in it. There's no blood in the game or whatever. I wanted to bet on ideas. I wanted to make sure that there was a contest of ideas. I wanted to be in the mix.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that about investing. And I find that that's what drives me every day. You know, there's always something new to study. You're always surprised. You're always wrong about something, and you have to revisit what you thought before.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have thought that I would end up on the path that I'm on now after doing your job. But it's similar in that sense where, you know, I do get paid if I prove that the Federal Reserve is dead wrong.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
yep.
Academics. Like, I can debate professors, like as Vivek was saying. You know, you have these experts and the elite that should be capitalized on.
Yep.
Or you can capitalize on dogma.
Yeah. Well, they've got no skin in the game. And they fall prey to all of these silly dogmas because they've never had their ideas tested. You know, you go into investing, right? You realize so quickly how many of your ideas are wrong, right? I mean, it doesn't take long, right? And it makes you up your game. It has to. But imagine if you'd just been, you know, just been thinking and writing papers about markets for 10 years and never actually put on a trade. You know, what would you have learned? What would you think? I mean, you'd have ideas that were just crazy. I mean, Boston, where I live, the mayor just decided that because the downtown office buildings aren't full, and so they've lost a lot of tax revenue, mm-hmm. that they should raise the tax on office buildings, right? That would, you know, you're just like, you know, where do these people come up with these crazy ideas?
Yeah, well, they come up with them in their own minds. And if applied to your P&L, that may...
yeah, exactly.
Well, it is, and it's a very safe place to be. And I'm not, like, I try to read a book every 10 days, or plenty that is born in academia that is, that is of a tremendous value. But really, just not when it comes to putting the rubber on the road. It's I think we're probably at the most obvious time where the establishment has its most powerful point, the establishment, the state, et cetera, versus the rest of us who get to capitalize on it.
Yes. Yes. I mean, and today's inflation print is, I think, a case in point of that.
I mean, everything from the inflation print, if you didn't understand inflation was accelerating, you completely just missed the 3-month move, which in your business, I know you're longer term, but that's a pretty big thing. Maybe not a 3-day move or a 3-week move.
Yeah. And we've been with you on that trade, Keith, which you've been very prescient on. But I think one of the drivers of it, which we looked at, which is even simpler than the analysis you did, is we just said, hey, does inflation trend? right? I mean, everybody says inflation's coming down. And I think that's often one of the most simple cognitive mistakes that investors make is using that present participle. You know, this business is growing. Inflation is coming down.
Right. Yes.
And you just say, no, inflation did come down or the business did grow. But what does that mean about the future? You know, don't just assume that everything kind of continues on a trend. And so we just took, you know, took CPI for a long period of time and looked at whether it trended. It turns out it does trend at the extreme, right? So if you have a huge drop in CPI or a huge spike, actually the next month you're likely to have an increase or decrease. But anywhere in the middle, sort of the middle of the distribution, past changes don't predict anything about the future. So we looked at that data and we said, look, there's no reason to think that because inflation is coming down that next month, what's the best prediction of inflation? Actually, it's inflation last month sometimes, right? Mm-hmm. And there are obviously much more sophisticated ways to do it, but it's a simple heuristic. That one works. And so we looked at inflation and said, look, there's no reason to think it's going to come down. Just because it's been coming down in the past. And therefore, you know, to us, that looks like short treasuries go long gold. I mean, all these, I think, quite basic trades that you make. And I think the inverted yield curve has been another sign of that as well.
So you, what percentage of your AUM is long short?
Around 10%.
Okay. So that's where you'd have the short duration bets on or short TLT, something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah. Yep. And we, you know, I think a lot I've learned from you, but I think we think about, in that fund, we think about three things. We think about what's our expected return, and that's where I think people have very low edge. It's really hard to get expected return right. Volatility, which we think, hey, you can actually do a really good job predicting volatility. Volatility really matters, right? Mm-hmm. If you don't know what expected return is, let's say you think it's 1% a month for something, right? A month where volatility is at 20% versus a month where volatility is at 10%, you want to be much more long in the month that's at 10%. It's a much better Sharpe ratio.
Well, to be clear for people, you're talking about the volatility of your portfolio, long-short portfolio.
Or every underlying asset, right? Okay. I think you can actually predict volatility much better than you can predict returns.
Agreed.
Right? You can understand and the structure of volatility. I mean, this is something that you write about a lot, and it matters, right? Because it, Sharpe ratio, whether you like it or not, if you can, it's return divided by vol. And if you can't predict returns, but you get vol right, that's going to make a big impact on your investment decision. And then the other thing is correlations, right? And I think that can provide very useful information, right? We see the stock-bond correlation going up. Well, bonds aren't going to be as good of a hedge. Mm-hmm. Turns out correlations are quite persistent. So if they were stock-bond correlation was high last month, it's probably going to be high this month. So if you have a bearish view on inflation, you know, you can short out treasuries and you're not going to be losing any hedging benefits.
Yeah. I mean, I'm actually quite surprised that that's all. I mean, you have a... You're just getting started, man. Like, you had the grind. Yeah, as you know, like, the art of running money is having money to run, right?
Yes.
And so you're like, once you get to a billion, now your hedge fund strategy is going to be much more interesting because you've achieved scale.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So for somebody like you to only, like, I'm not trying to poo-poo $100 million. Getting actually from 50 to 100 is the hardest part.
Oh, yes.
Or getting from 0 to 50, then yeah. There's a two-step dance there. So that seemingly is a big opportunity. In particular, if you can go anywhere, do you have the global mandate on the long short?
Yes, and that's something I really agree with you on, Keith, because especially the benefits of volatility and correlation analysis, right? You need to broaden your aperture. Right. I mean, you look at just simply adding gold versus just owning bonds. Right. If you can think about gold and bonds. Right. You've already got added a degree of freedom that can be really valuable and they respond to inflation differently. Right. And then if you can say, hey, gee, I'm not confined to a specific regional mandate. I can go ex-US. I can go to Japan or something where things are quite interesting. But the more you can diversify your portfolio and look at a broader set of markets, the more potential it is to build better portfolios, right? I mean, it's just, this is something where the academics would agree, right? The more you broaden your aperture, the more diverse assets you have, the better you're going to do. And you can use, I think, correlations and volatility to make better portfolio decisions, even again, if you have no edge on expected returns. Yeah.
One of the most revealing backtests of my career was that a breakdown in trending volatility of an asset class is going to correlate with a sustained breakout of the volatility of the prices of those of the assets in the asset class and vice versa. And, Ray Dalio kind of taught people that. And it's harder to teach people that unless you're running that. Like, you got to run the book to understand where the vol flips are and when you undergo a phase transition. Like, a great example right now, let's go back to inflation. Then I want to come back to go anywhere on the regional opportunities. But, you know, commodities as an asset class, unbeknownst to people who are still like, oh, there was no recession. I mean, you had a global industrial recession, manufacturing recession, global commodity recession. That clearly, from a vol perspective, the vol peaked into October of last year, started to break down throughout the end of the year. And now we're in, this is like very hard to find.
Yeah.
And commodities, the last one we went on, our signal got that one right too. It's actually easier to get that asset class because there's no storytelling like relative to the meme stocks or whatever. But it's you know, coming out of 2020, it was a 2-year bull market, and then it was a great bear market short for a year, year and a half to 2 years, and now here we go again.
Yeah.
Do you agree with being long commodities as an asset class, and or two, are you expressing that in equities?
So right now we're long gold. We like gold a lot.
That thing's been a rifle.
I wish we'd been long oil because we missed that one.
Yep.
But I think
silver. You long silver?
No, we actually don't trade silver. We've been working on some research on it, but we're not there yet.
That would be when you backtest that. Like that is my worst batting average out of anything. Right, I've ever
maybe that's why we haven't done it. Yet.
It's brutal, man. Yeah, it's silver stuff. But anyway, gold.
Yeah, but I like gold, and I think to your point, when we look at our ability to predict gold, we believe we have zero ability to predict expected returns on gold. I mean, gold is really hard asset to trade, right? I mean, if you say, hey, I'm going to trade gold with inflation, or I'm going to trade gold with rates, and you draw a correlation between rates or inflation and gold, you see nothing. But actually, if you study the volatility and the correlation patterns, you can see that gold can be a really important asset class to have, right? And especially at times like this, where you've seen actually gold volatility coming down a lot. So it's been, you've got basically an uncorrelated asset with a decent long-term, you know, nominal return, where volatility has dropped a lot. And so the attractiveness of owning gold in a portfolio has gone up, not down. And I think that's part of what you're seeing. I think when you talk about these changes in the volatility structure driving returns, it's because of people doing portfolio math, right? When volatility comes down in asset class, people want to own more of it because the relative Sharpe ratio has improved.
Mm-hmm. So have you broadened that into the next question people are going to have is like into the to the graveyards of gold miners or no?
We don't have too many views on gold miners at the moment.
Yeah. Okay, good. We could skip that topic, but so let's just take a step like to the other side. You've written about what isn't working.
Yep.
Like my alma mater, the Swenson endowment model. There's a reason why he and I didn't quite get along.
Yep.
And that's fine. You know, David Salem, who's partner of mine here, is. He was good friends with him. Rest in peace, Swenson, and all that he accomplished. I mean, tremendous accomplishments and tremendous returns for a long period of time.
Yep.
But though that model is undergoing what I would call a phase transition, and it's and you write about it a lot. I mean, can you talk about that in terms of its underperformance? Well, first, maybe just tell people what you're talking about when you talk about the endowment model. And talking about its underperformance.
Yeah. So you saw basically, I mean, the endowment model these days has come to mean 40% in private equity. That's the new,
40.
Which is kind of insane, right? And I think part of, just to contextualize why that's insane, right? The average private equity deal is about $200 million in market cap, right? So, which is obviously half the high end of the microcap index. So you think, okay, so private equity is microcap equity asset class. Well, how much of global equity market cap do microcaps account for? And it's like 1% or 2%. So you're saying, okay, gee, I think that the best idea I have is to put 40% of my portfolio on something that's 1% to 2% of global market cap, right? It's a little bit insane. And then you think of what are the attributes of microcaps relative to large caps. One is that they're a heck of a lot more volatile. You're layering on that private equity is adding debt, so you're taking an already much more volatile type of stock, and you're adding debt to it. And then I think finally, what you've seen, and I trade a lot of small cap equities, right? The quality of small caps is lower than that of large caps. It just is.
Yep.
Right? They have lower margins. They're less diversified. You know, any type of macroeconomic hit hits small caps worse than they bounce back better. But that's very much true of private equity backed companies, right? So what I've looked at, so last year was the first year really in a few years where private equity really underperformed public mm-hmm. markets. And so the endowments look horrible relative to a 60-40 portfolio or anybody that didn't have privates. Privates were basically flat and the market was up, 20 or something.
Right? Looking terrible compared to a 60-40 is really terrible.
It is indeed. And so one of the things that I thought, one of the explanations for that is just that they didn't mark down when the markets went down and they didn't mark up when the markets came back, right? And so maybe it's just return smoothing. And I think that's a plausible hypothesis, but I wanted to go a level deeper. So I said, let's look at every company that issues public debt that's private equity owned, so we can actually look at the financials. And what you actually saw is that last year, these companies were actually growing slower than public markets, and they have basically zero margins, zero net income margins, zero free cash flow generation, right? These businesses are very fragile, and the reason for that is they took on a huge amount of floating rate debt because private equity is backed by private credit. And so, and private credit is the hottest thing among institutional investors at the moment, because basically the private credit firms are offering, you know, 12, 14% yields to lend to these private equity backed companies. And they are telling the institutional investor, well, these are great companies. They're owned by private equity firms. So if you want to put 40% of your money in private equity, right, that's that equity is subordinated to these bonds that are yielding 12 to 14%. And what we like to say is, like, just use some basic common sense, right? If a buddy of yours came and said, hey, Keith, can I borrow some money from you? I'll pay you 15% interest, right? Would you sort of say to yourself, well, gee, you know, why couldn't he get money from a bank? And, you know, if the bank wouldn't lend it to him at 6 or 7, why would I lend him at 50? There must be some problem with this guy, right? Well, the same intuition applies to companies, right? Like, there are no great companies that have to borrow 14%, right? I mean, we're starting to get into, you know, pawn shop territory. And yet, I think because of this lack of mark-to-market, and again, it's a little bit like academics, right? If you never see the results of your portfolio, it's all smooth. You know, how are you going to know when you made mistakes? You're not going to learn as fast. And I think that's what's happened in private equity and private credit. And they've been bailed out because rates have been zero, and so who cares, right? They can just extend and pretend. But I think now that rates have spiked, and those, by the way, those floating that floating rate debt is hitting these private equity-backed companies pretty hard. Part of the reason they're not growing is because they can't invest in growth because all their free cash flow has to go to interest payment. And I think now we're starting to see the consequences of that for the endowment portfolios. And I just think as a mental model of the world, you know, giving your money to the Carlyles and Blackstones of the world and saying, hey, gee, these are a bunch of smart guys who are going to own companies better than I would own them. I just don't like that sort of trust the experts model versus saying, let's trade everything that's liquid. We'll know our P&L on a day-to-day basis, and we can go anywhere that's attractive on a day-to-day basis, not have our capital locked up at 2 and 20 for a decade.
Robert McGrory here, Director of Subscriber Development at HedgeEye. Hope you're enjoying our podcast. Start generating alpha with our suite of Sector Pro investing research products. Dive deep into retail, industrials, technology, and everything in between, with exclusive access to the sharpest analysts and actionable ideas on Wall Street.
Go to hedgeye.com/research
to subscribe. Enjoy the rest of this episode.
Now, if you went to, have you gone to the Harvard Endowment and told them this and presented this? Would you get that audience? I would never get that. It's interesting. My office was, I could hit a driver off the top from the front porch of HedgeEye's initial building to Swenson's office, and not once did they entertain a conversation with us. I'm a Yale alum who gives not an inconsequential amount of money to Yale either. It's saying something, right? It's saying that the answer, correct me, is, yeah, my friend, is not blowing in the wind here. It's like they didn't want to have the
discussion.
Like, is that the likely answer here?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I spoke at an institutional investor conference, and I had a debate between me and a consultant on whether people should be doing more or less private equity. I said less. He said more. And we had this long debate.
And he's a consultant to private equity?
A consultant to endowments. Like, he's an endowment consultant.
Okay.
So, and we had this great back and forth where I said, these are levered microcap pieces of shit, and
nobody says it that way.
Right. And you're putting 40% in your portfolio and thinking it's risk-free. I mean, you just got to be insane. Nobody's thinking about this right. And so then they said at the end of the debate, the host said, okay, raise your hand if you think who won the debate. And I pretty clearly won the debate. And then I said to the guy, Kip, who was hosting the debate, I said, Kip, ask him a different question. Ask whether they're going to do anything about it. Like, ask them if any of them are going to lower their private equity allocation. Nobody raised their hand, right?
Really?
So I think you've got to separate out that there's a gap between sort of an intellectual argument, where I actually think a lot of institutional investors even are sympathetic to the argument that private equity might have problems, or maybe it isn't the best thing since sliced bread. But the way things are done is that is the standard, and that's what everybody does, and they can't question it. It's just what they do. And so until private equity returns are materially worse than public markets, and again, last year they were for the first time in a while, I don't think you're going to see any behavior change.
Well, I mean, I don't know how. Well, they will behave. They'll behave when it's far too late. Let's just be clear on that. And if they're big enough, they can hide it for long enough, like BREIT. Blackstone, obviously, had plenty of issues there. But if you can't change that, going back to the beginning of this, the discussion, that inflation is higher for longer and therefore interest rates are higher for longer, don't you really just take... I could take a line from when Swenson became Swenson of interest rates to where he became the glorious of days of Swenson Alpha for that type of strategy. And it's every single time interest rates go to zero that there's an economic problem, there's bailouts, you know, private equity wins. It's not, we're reversing the number one factor.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And I think one of the ironies of this, right, is the endowment model, if you think about it, was born out of the 70s. And the experience of the 70s is that both stocks and bonds did badly. And so
At the same time.
And yep. So people in the endowment world said, hey, gee, you know, we need to do something other than stocks and bonds in order to make more money. And what they came up with was to borrow money to buy smaller stocks, which, you know, whatever. It was a great idea back then.
Or in Buffett's case, because I wrote my senior thesis about this. He was apoplectic about that.
Yep.
Right? This fundamentally, to the fundamentalist, doesn't make sense that a stock can go to 4-6 times cash flow, 4-6 times earnings, maybe 3 times cash flow. So he just said, I'm just going to buy an insurance company and buy up those cash flows.
Yep.
Right? But there was only one him.
Yep.
And then there's this whole private equity industry.
And so what ended up happening, which is sort of interesting, is that the large endowments and foundations, what they did is they didn't actually change their equity allocations. They kept, you know, if they had a 60-40 allocation, they didn't change, at least initially they have now, but they didn't initially change that 60% in equities. What they did is they took the 40% in bonds.
Yes.
And they put that in private equity. And what's very important to realize is that private equity's volatility is about equal to that of corporate bonds. So their portfolio's aggregate volatility didn't go up, but they dramatically increased their equity risk.
Yep.
And that was actually a good thing, right? You all else equal prefer to have 100% equity than a 60-40 portfolio. And I think that then what you've seen, which is sort of funny, right, is that actually if you'd bought the 30-year bond in 1980 and held it to maturity, you would have done just fine too. So the whole premise of it, which is that bonds are bad and replace them with micro-cap equities, you know, there were some intellectual flaws to it. But I just think that once everybody adopts something, right? That's sort of my ultimate like meta view of markets, right? Is that you got to be thinking investing is not a game of analysis; it's a game of meta analysis. Doesn't matter what you think; it's what you think relative to what everyone else thinks. And so, the minute something becomes so consensus, especially when it's like when the smart money is like 20x overweight something, you got to step back and say, just like, hey, without it's a little bit like volatility versus expected returns. So you have no view on expected returns, but you really know that everyone else is really excited about something. Your first instinct should be, hey, let's fade that because that's likely overbought.
Yeah,
and there's nothing more overbought today than private equity.
When you say it like that, you remind me, and there are people have compared you post our first discussion. In I shouldn't say totally different styles, but you and David Einhorn in terms of like how you articulate things. I put you across between J. Van Sciver and David Einhorn. Because you have the same kind of like sense of humor as Jay.
Thank you, Keith.
You have that go anywhere, you know, irreverence about you. But Einhorn says that a lot. Like, you know, I forget what Hedgeye Live he gave that presentation, whereas it's like you get into these crowding of strategies, right? Now, the most recent one in the hedge fund industry is to run neutral at every factor and sector and whatever exposure, and you got to run it with a lot of leverage. So there's that one, too. But I do think, I mean, here's a simple way to ask the question to, like, people that are watching. Why is it that only Warren Buffett is allowed to, you know, be innovative and change the way that it is for an economic situation, which is stagflation? Rolling stagflation of the 1970s with rising interest rates and a hawkish Fed, or Swenson, or Dalio. Dalio started being 60-40 because he took the 40 and he said, I'm going to create tips, get Larry Summers I'm going to get these guys at the Treasury to sign off on it, and anytime duration goes down, I'm going to outperform that part of the 40. That was his big thing, right? So why do all these old guys get to innovate, but the young guy who's 10 years into it just ready to... You know, take a good bite out of their ass. Like, why not?
Yeah. Well, my goal is to innovate, right? I mean, I think that's what I love about capitalism, right? I mean, you've got a chance, right? Nobody's going to tell you you can't do it, and you got to try it. And look, you'll make mistakes. I've made mistakes. But that's the fun of the game. I mean, that's what any businessman loves, right? You love getting in there, trying to build something, trying to make something new, seeing what works, seeing what doesn't work, changing things.
Yeah.
And I think for me, I love, I'm a student, right? I love studying. I mean, I love reading your stuff, right? I think that, you know, your understanding of volatility structures, your, you know, study of inflation, you've been so right on a lot of that stuff. And I think that, for me, that's what makes me passionate about markets, right? You can not only go and study this stuff, but then if you get a broad mandate, you can go and express these views, you know, almost anywhere, right? Mm-hmm. And you can, these assets are all liquid. You can open up an interactive broker's account and you can trade currency futures, commodity futures, anything.
Again, in like technological innovation, time and space creates opportunities for new, let's go to the, like, we're going to get there. We were eventually going to get there. Go anywhere strategy.
Yeah.
Like when I started in this business, you'd have to, first of all, never mind when I started in this business, by the time I started my own hedge fund, you had to have so many swaps contracts in place to trade currencies that you'd go broke just starting the damn place.
Yes. Yes.
Right? Now, there are over 2,700 ETFs that we track every night on our Trade Trend Tail model. There are no fees. You can go anywhere is only defined by those that are going anywhere.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas over here, I think the answer is, and I said, why don't you take a bite out of their ass, which is a little crude. I get that, but it's a hockey player thing. It's because their ass is too big.
Yep, yep.
Right? It's all these people. If David Swensen was still alive, he would stay with that to the grave anyway.
Yep.
Right? Because that's what they do. That's what they get paid to do, and there is nothing that's going to change that. Not some clever idea from some Harvard guy.
Yep. Well, I love, it's what you're saying. So, I think technological innovation has been amazing. I love interactive brokers, but we use it, but
it's great.
It's great. And one funny story. So we use interactive brokers and we get pitched all these prime brokerage services by the big banks. And so we had one of them come in and pitch us. And I said, well, you know, right now we use interactive brokers. You know, if we were to, you know, talk to me what we'd get if we went a prime brokerage with your big bank. And I said, well, they said, well, first you needed some infrastructure. So what infrastructure? Well, you need this OMS software. So how much does that cost? $100,000 a year. So I need that. So what else do I need? I said, well, you need someone to do end of day trade reconciliation. I said, well, how much does that cost? $150,000 a year. Okay, great. And then I said, what else do I need? And I said, well, we need you to have a CFO. And so I said, well, how much does the CFO cost? About $300,000 a year. I'd say, so I need $300,000 for the CFO, $150,000 for the trade settlement person, $100,000 for the OMS software. And then how do your trade costs compare to interactive brokers? 40 basis points higher. So I pay more of the trade costs. And then I said, and you think this is a good idea for my business? And I said, yes. And actually, right, you're probably thinking, where can I hire these people? We have two hedge funds in Boston that just went bankrupt. And we could just port one of their teams over to you. And I said, well, do you think there's any connection between them paying higher trade costs, spending $500,000 on non-investment professionals and random software so they can interface with your Wall Street bank, and the fact that these hedge funds went bankrupt, like, do you see a connection? Because I do. Like, I just thought it was the craziest thing in the world.
I'm Goldman Sachs Prime Brokerage. I'm here to help. It's a thing.
Yep.
Right? No matter where you go, it's going to be a thing. And it still will take some time, but I don't think and maybe that's why they're such an unrelenting, like, want, begging, demand for interest rate cuts.
Yep.
Because it's the only thing that they know keeps the game going the way that it stands.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, and there's huge political pressure to it, right? I mean, if you read sort of the history of the relationship between the presidents and the Fed, right? Historically, presidents have always tried to bully the Fed into lowering rates because they knew it would, you know, goose things.
Yeah.
And I think you think there's, you know, political pressure right now. I think a lot of the, you know, private equity firms and the banks would like rates to be lower. But I think that, you know, the lessons of the 70s are very present in the minds of today's policymaker. And one of the lessons of the 70s is that inflation can come back. And it did that several times in the 70s. People thought they had it beat and it came back. And so don't declare victory too early. And I think to the Fed's credit, and I know that a lot of folks on Hedgeye have a lot of critiques of the Fed, and a lot of those are merited. But on the other hand, I think that they've been right in not
at the time when others were declaring victory, saying, "Oh, now is the time to cut rates."
Right. No, right? I agree.
They've been right about that. Let's wait. And I think they've been saying all the right things on that front. Because you see with this latest report today, yeah. right, inflation just doesn't go away magically.
I would say that they basically are in this oh shit moment,
yeah.
right? Like,
yeah.
oh, we're going to make the same mistake that we made before, which is calling it transitory and that we're, you know, no longer on the path or whatever. They just can't get it out of their mouth. I mean, Bianco made a good point yesterday, which is they committed to the evildoer that is a calendar guidance.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And he said, they should just get rid of that.
Yep.
And just take every data point and readjust the sales.
Yeah.
If they were to do that, I would compliment them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But if you're going to, the reason why I rip on them, one, it's easy because I'm looking at the data that's going up, and they're saying the data is going bumpy, so that's a lie. And two, it's just the dogma of the institution.
Yes.
Yes. So I wonder, like, if that's, you know, the thing with the 1970s, don't forget, isn't that inflation would go away and come back. It's that it would rip, and then it would come down, but it didn't go away.
Yep.
And then it would, Arthur right. Burns would cut interest rates, pander to his political base, and boom, you'd get a resurgence. There's a very good chance that that happens.
Yeah. And there's a very interesting paper that recently came out, and Larry Summers was one of the co-authors. And one of the arguments said, you know, the media has been saying, hey, there's a disconnect between people saying that the economy is bad and the experts in Washington saying that it's good. So what's driving this disconnect, right? Or is everybody stupid or or is something that the government's doing wrong? And what this paper said is, well, actually, a large percentage of Americans borrow money. They have credit card debt, right? And so when they're looking at part of their P&L, they're seeing their interest costs go up, right? Their prices and the effect of the price of credit being so high is actually significantly worse, right? So their cash take-home is actually significantly worse because they're paying this credit interest rate. And if you account for that, you can understand a lot of the gap between the perceptions of the average American and what's going on in the government. So there's this huge political pressure to cut rates, mm-hmm. right?
I mean, I almost got up and grabbed... I'm actually going to grab something. I've never done that during a real conversation, so apologies for that. But exhibit number one has 160 slides.
Yep.
That shows only cycle data that would, again, not only aggregate the cycle, but break it down into the K-shaped economy. That's actually the answer.
Yep.
Like, when you look at the 44%, like Bianco says, you can rattle it off however you want. You can say, like I say, 50% of Americans have no savings, not a dollar to their name. Bianco's like, 44% of Americans couldn't get to $1,000 by the end of the week if they tried. You can look at it however you want. But it's a K-shaped economy.
Yep.
You're either the taker of the risk-free rate, like me and you.
Yep.
Like, you'd have to be, and I'm talking to all of you, if you have to be certifiably stupid to not put if you've built some kind of a pile over the course of 15, 20, 25 years, maybe 10, to not put X percent into a 5% risk-free rate that you could change, you know, after you pick your nose. I mean, this is the supreme opposite example of what Dan explained, which is illiquid garbage in private equity that you could never get out of if you tried.
Yep.
Right? So there is, like, that answer is going to really continue to rip at American culture. You know, it's going to, I wonder how fast and how furious it's going to be. Because Trump, let's say Trump wins, do you think that he's going to all of a sudden, you know, sign off on Paul Volcker part two,
like no.
raising interest rates, cutting the deficit?
Yep. No, I don't think so. He's a populist.
Right?
Hi, Robert McGrory here, Director of Subscriber Development at Agi. Join our entire research analyst team live before the market opens for deep dive investing analysis, our favorite stock ideas, and our risk manager-in-chief, Keith McCullough's macro overlay. Our team of 40-plus equity analysts discuss key market developments, trends, and our high-conviction long and short investing ideas. You will not get this granular level of insight anywhere else. A video replay, audio version, and analyst summary notes from the call are available shortly after each live show to ensure you don't miss anything. Go to hedgeye.com/research to subscribe and tune in live to the call weekdays at 7:45 a.m. Eastern. Enjoy the rest of this episode.
He prefer? I mean, what would he like somebody to do to his own balance sheet problems?
Right. Exactly. Right. He wants stocks to go up.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And he wants the debt balance to go down.
Yep.
Right. He wants a jubilee.
Yep.
I mean, so. I can get back to that, but I think a lot of Hedgeye Nation's reviewed, you know, the data.
Yep.
The data is the data. You can't run away from it, right? I mean, I think you had a great quote in here.
Yeah, you did. How about this? At least my memory's not shot by the end of the day, but
Dan wrote, investors should be motivated by data, not myths.
Yep.
What else did you mean by that?
I think that's my entire philosophy of investing, right? And I think that a lot of that is breaking away from the narratives that you're getting sold, right? The present participle of inflation is coming down, or
yes,
this company is growing, or whatever that story might be, and saying, hey, gee, did A lead to B in the past, right? Can we look at how A connects to B? Let's break it down as a predictive thing. And when you start to do that, you know, one of the things you find is the future is much harder to predict than you think it is. And I think then you start to unpack things that maybe give you a little bit of edge, where you can start, I've learned a lot of this from you, but studying volatility, right? The more you can focus on volatility, because volatility is something that's predictable, right? You can get that right consistently over time. Mm-hmm. And if you get that right consistently over time, it gives you an edge, even if you have no edge in returns.
Accurate, indeed. Guys, go to slide 80, 81, 82. We're just going to show at least three pictures of what Dan's saying. Now, this is a good example. So this is the NFIB small business earnings. So this is where all this small cap or this private equity crap would live, right?
Yep.
It's private.
Yeah.
It's not publicly listed. It's private. That's what their earnings have done. That's not like, you would be wrong to, like, all these people that had the recession wrong, they'd be wrong. That's a depression. The rate of change of the Russell 2000's net income was down 35%. So,
yep.
I mean, year over year. So you have that dynamic on the left side. So this is like a big part, like we call it, for the consumer and the corporate K. On the consumer side, so this is, you know, and again, a lot of small businesses, those are your consumers. It's 97% of U.S. businesses. So the average interest rate paid on short-term debt just went bonkers. Next slide, 81. And then finally, when you summarize all this on slide 82, since really the start of the hiking cycle, this is what the household balance sheet has done. Right? There are no assets, net. There is only credit and debt.
Right.
Right? And that is, how do you say that the same way for private equity? Isn't
it? I just thought, right, it's exactly what you're saying, Keith, right? Like, you look at those earnings, and like you said, look, these are small, risky, cyclical businesses who are getting hammered, right? They're getting hammered on the top line, right? Especially relative to your, you know, large cap public equities, right? At the same time, they're borrowers. Right, and you don't want to be a floating rate borrower in this type of environment. You kidding? Right, that's the last thing you want to be. So you're a microcap business with declining or, you know, stagnant revenues and massively jacked up interest rate costs because you borrowed floating in 2020. Right, I mean, it's just a disaster. And yet again, this is everybody has 40. All these institutions, the Harvards and the Yales of the world, they have 40% of their money in this stuff.
Mm-hmm. You know, my 25th reunion at Yale is coming up. I've had mixed feelings about it for different reasons, but maybe I'll kind of like, you can kind of play with it a bit now, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? Well, maybe I'll give you that, but you're going to give me this?
Yep, yep.
You're going to give me an audience in front of the Yale Endowment with all of these graduates that I know that are in the business, actually? Give me that. I'll give you a lot.
Yep.
Right? Because. Yep. You know, that's this just needs to happen. It's happening right now. Like, this is why we're having part of this conversation. I didn't know it was going to go there. But in terms of solutions, though, like, if we do that, if you take a big bite out of our ass to use the same thing, where are we going to go?
Yeah.
What are we going to do? All these deals. I mean, can you talk about go anywhere?
Yep.
Let's just do equities.
Yep.
Global equities.
Yep.
What the returns have looked like.
Yep.
What the opportunities could be.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, I think so. I've been, for the past few years, I thought that my best idea was Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been very bullish on Japan. And I think that, you know, there are positive bubbles and there are negative bubbles. And Japan was in a negative bubble, right, where everybody had given
up.
No one wanted it, right? There were a million stories. You talk to anybody, say, hey, are you overweight or underweight, Japan? Underweight. Why are you underweight? Aging population, too much debt, right? Bad corporate governance, right? But if you look at one funny stat we did is that over the last decade, Japanese EPS growth has been higher than U.S. EPS growth. Mm-hmm. Why? Because the corporate governance changes, right? If you start bad and you go, if you start really bad and you go to mediocre, that's a very positive rate of change, right?
Yeah.
So versus the U.S., right, which it doesn't have anywhere more to go in terms of being more shareholder friendly, right? And so what you've seen in Japan, and it's a huge wasteland, especially for small cap equities, right? I think 50% of Japanese companies trade at below 1x book, about, right? And so, and the government and the stock exchange find this to be an embarrassment, which it is. And so they've said every company that trades at below book has to issue a plan how they're going to get to 1x book, right? And the implicit threat, it's not explicit, but the implicit threat is, hey, we're going to delist you or punish you. So I've said, look, you can go to this market where you can buy stuff at half book. Right, half book. When was the last time you do that in the United States? Right, you're paying 3.5x book here, and where the trends are headed in the right direction. Right, like you used to say, hey, Japanese, debt to GDP was horrendous. Well, if you looked at U.S. debt to GDP recently, right, at least Japan, it's trending in the right direction.
Yeah,
right?
Just staying there.
Right. At least it's a better trend.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing, the devaluation of the yen has been a huge spur to the exports.
Major.
And then I think also there's been a lot of money that's been in this. My sister manages an endowment. She has a different last name than me. She doesn't like to be identified because I'm too controversial.
Oh, you cannot do that to her.
So, but she a few years back, she called me and said, Dan, I've been going to all these endowment CIO conferences. And everyone's talking about China. China this, Chinese venture. She said, Chinese venture, that is the stupidest fucking thing I've ever heard of. So you're going to put your money into an illiquid, tiny little illiquid companies in a communist country? Right? Like, what are you thinking? Right? And they're all like, oh, I just got back from Beijing. She said, this is the biggest crock of shit. You got to write something about this. So I went and write some nasty thing about China.
So now we know where you get.
Yeah, exactly. My sister has a lot of my great ideas. But the point was right, and there's so much money that's allocated to sort of pan-Asian, I have an Asia allocation. Well, all that money's going out of China right now. I mean, right, like people are realizing that the writing's on the wall. They're pulling their money out of China, and if they're growth-oriented, they're going to India. Well, by the way, good luck getting your money out of India. And if they're value-oriented, they're going to Japan. So, Japan is the recipient of a lot of these fund outflows from China, which I think is another, quite bullish thing for the country.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, anytime you come out of a global industrial recession, export countries, particularly Japan, now Singapore is signaling on our model like that they're finally coming out of one. I think that's the biggest level of macro unawareness people have is that they didn't know they had that.
Yep.
Because they're like kind of droned into the spy monkey view that there's no recessions anywhere, anytime. So why would you think of never anytime you could go anywhere?
And on that point, I think a lot of U.S. investors, one of the things we looked at is we just created an aggregate daily index of revenue for companies based on the region they're in, right? And so every time a company's earnings report comes out, it updates that index, and you can sort of see it in real time. And what's interesting
about that... You just use that internally? Or?
Yeah, just internally.
Yeah.
And it's not hard to do. But once you start to look at that, one of the things that you notice, and I think this is central to the mind of U.S. investors, is that the U.S., corporate U.S. is much less volatile than international corporate, right? So the cycle in the U.S. is muted when you look at our companies, right? And part of that's the tech bias, part of that's how diversified our economy is, right? But the U.S. investor is not used to big cyclical swings. Foreign investors are, right? You go to Europe or you go to Japan, you're seeing a much more volatile corporate series. You go to Kiev, obviously, you're seeing just crazy, crazy vol. But I think that that's part of why investors are missing this stuff, right? They're conditioned to not think as much about the cycle because in the U.S. the cycle isn't as big of a thing as it used to be, or at least hasn't been the last 10 years relative to going ex-US.
It's mainly why so many people have missed India.
Yep.
I mean, if you guys show, I think it's slide 35, we show the quads, but also in the middle of the chart you can see the growth rates. I mean, for India to sustain an 8% real GDP growth rate. And this isn't like the China number, which is made up.
That's real.
China makes up 5 and it's 3 or 0, whatever. But India, like, this has been really hard for people to understand because they're expecting cyclicality.
Yep.
And what Modi's done has created, what I'm looking for, which is a lower volatility profile of both the economic reality and therefore the economic index, or in this case, the equity index. So I think that's a big one.
Yep.
Like that's one that we will often get institutional clients will say, I missed it. Nice call.
Yep.
Isn't that
yep.
the worst?
Yep.
Hey, nice call, Daniel.
Yeah.
Long Japan.
Right, right,
yes.
right, right,
I,
right.
I missed it. I'm too smart.
And now it's over, so there's nothing for me to do, right? You're like, well.
I can't do that. Intellectually, I missed it, the valuation, but I'm going to buy Mag 7.
Right, right, right.
Like, I'm going to put Mag 7 in my 6040 or whatever on that. Yeah, on that, too, I think that, like, that's kind of attacking the weak at its weakest point.
Yep.
I mean, because you're really... 60/40 is still down, depending on what, you know, kind of like target date fund or whatever you had. It's still down double digit from 2021.
Yep.
Nobody wants to talk about it. You know, let's talk about Mag 5 now because the terrible two with Apple and Tesla are breaking down. But do you, is that, have you gone after 60/40 yet? You've kind of gone after most things.
Yeah. You know, I think I've written a fair amount about how you need to diversify your portfolio.
Right. 60/40 is not diversified.
Right, right. But I will say where I defend 60/40 is relative to the endowment model. If you said, would you rather 40% of your money in private equity or 40% of your money in like short-term treasuries, I'd take short-term treasuries, right? So
that is the most backhanded compliment. Like, I mean, it's like so bad.
Like I said, Dalio became a billionaire by picking off that 40.
Yep, yep.
Creating his own securities.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
That's awesome.
Yep.
Well, that's capitalism,
yep.
right? That to have the, you know, the, whatever. But inside of that 40, I just think that, again, if you're higher for longer, it's just implied.
Yep.
You know, it's just going to decay. And that's going to be a tough thing. It's a tough thing for people like my mom, like retired teacher, my dad, retired firefighter, pensions, because yep. they have those, and it's in Canada.
Yep.
So they have the really, like wounded wildebeest type, I call it model. I don't know if you've heard my wildebeest versus the lion.
Yeah.
I call the Fed the wildebeest.
Yep.
They're cornered. Their Fed heads are drooping. They know it's going to, you know, but they don't really know. They don't really have to have it end.
Yep. Yep.
You just see all these retirees who are like, my mom for the first time last year called me about her retirement account.
Yep.
She's like, why does it go down all the time?
Yep. It's a good question.
Well, I mean, more phone calls like that, maybe the biting of the ass starts to happen a little faster. So,
yeah. But, yeah, I mean, and I think that's another important frame that people don't often think of, right? It's like, you know, a lot of what's in every U.S. investor's head is a lot of very U.S.-specific concepts, right? If you talk to someone who's lived in emerging markets, they're much more aware of currencies. They're much more worried about inflation, much more worried about cycles. They're much more aware of a lot of these very important dynamics. And so the minute you start to go anywhere and you start to look at data that's not just U.S. data, you come to a very different perspective on a lot of these big issues.
Agreed. And I find, again, back to the technological time and space point, it is way easier for me to buy Malaysia, short Thailand. There's shorts too. I mean, there are different countries that are totally screwing it up. Turkey, for example. But you've never really been able to execute on a strategy like that effectively. Back to like, you know, as Rasmussen bean counts, like how Goldman's trying to rip them off at the prime brokerage level. You do that with my strategy. You know, I have 40 different asset allocations globally.
Yep.
If you had to pay 1980s transaction costs, that doesn't work.
Right. You can the ETFs are amazing. Right. Yeah. There's a Malaysia ETF, right? How crazy is that? Right.
Yeah. I mean it's got good, you know, that's been a big one for us. So and this has been a great conversation for me. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Keith, for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for making the time. Anytime we can do the one-on-one, it's better.
It's a blast.
Yeah, I appreciate it. He's Dan. We're trying to get Dan to the Harvard Endowment Meeting, all right? Now, we know what my strategy is to get to the Yale Endowment Meeting, but it's probably not going to work. So he's nicer. He's younger. It's doable. So help him if you're a Harvard alumni.
Not Canadian.
Well, you're not a Canadian. but we have seen people make some headway against the establishment at Harvard as of late. So,
it's true.
So so you're saying there's a chance. Thank you for joining us today. I'll see you for day three, the final day tomorrow of the Investing Summit.
Thanks for listening to the Hedgeye Investing Summit, featuring conversations with some of the sharpest minds in investing. To get access to the other 8 Hedgeye Investing Summit conversations and for more great investing content, go to hedgeye.com.
Don't forget to check out hedgeye.com to get more actionable investing insights from our team of more than 40 research analysts. And check us out on Twitter at our handle, @hedgeye. This presentation is informational only. None of the information contained herein constitutes an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security or investment vehicle, nor does it constitute investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice by Hedgeye or any of its employees, officers, agents, or guests. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. This content is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. Hedgeye is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual expressing those opinions and conclusions and are intended solely for the use of Hedgeye subscribers and the authorized recipients of the content. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information contained herein is protected by United States and foreign copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient. Access must be provided directly by Hedgeye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited. For more detail, please refer to the terms of service at hedgeye.com/terms of service.